From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, how raw milk has turned into such a controversial issue in a place called the Dairy State.
Whatever side you are on, you're absolutely convinced that you've got the totality of important information about it, I think is the simplest point.
Then photographer Paul Calhoun's new exhibit is a retrospective of 7 years of work from both home and abroad.
I've gone places and tried to experience things, and I guess if my photographs succeed or fail are basically related to the depth of my experience.
An essayist offers some guidelines for interacting with those who grieve. And then, how words Shakespeare wrote centuries ago are helping modern-day veterans reclaim their civilian lives. Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio, and I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in. A bill that would loosen restrictions on sales of raw milk in Wisconsin is still pending. The bill passed a state Senate committee in November, but has not advanced past that stage. Supporters of raw milk sales cite what they see as health benefits, while opponents cite data showing health risks from drinking unpasteurized milk. Even without the legislation, it has been a strident debate in a state already associated with dairy products. Advocates have been willing to risk arrest in their efforts to buy or sell raw milk, and they've taken some unusual steps as well. Eric Gunn writes about the debate in the March issue of Milwaukee Magazine. He tells Mitch Tyke why he believes raw milk is such a flashpoint for controversy.
Because whatever side you are on, you're absolutely convinced that you've got the totality of important information about it, I think is the simplest point. And I think that if you're a physician or a member of the dairy industry, you're certainly aware of the potential hazards, and that looms above everything else. If you're one of the people who has had a personal experience that leads you to believe that this is a strongly beneficial product, then you are inclined to be suspicious of anyone who has a somewhat different point of view.
Well, let's start really with a few simple questions. And the basic one is, what are the key reasons that people choose to become raw milk consumers?
The people that I've spoken with usually, I think, encountered, you know, some information elsewhere that made it a more appealing. But secondly, when they consume it themselves, they claim better flavor, positive health impacts.
Specifically, they talk about digestion.
Digestion. The pro-raw milk community tends to advance a theory that what many adults experience is lactose intolerance is really a byproduct of pasteurization rather than milk in general. This theory is not necessarily accepted in mainstream science. I want to be clear about that. But other people who have consumed raw milk and made it part of their diet just attribute all kinds of beneficial health effects to it. The other big thing, and again, mainstream science is very skeptical about this, but is the notion that there are not necessarily pathogenic bacteria, but a greater variety of bacteria in raw milk that people consuming it are then exposed to, that has the effect of bolstering the immune system.
Raw milk cannot legally be sold in Wisconsin, but what is the way around that restriction that advocates and raw milk producers have?
The way around it is one that it's at this point a legal gray area. But let me back up for a second. The law has never said that a farm family consuming the raw milk from their own cattle is doing anything in violation of the law. That is not considered to be in public commerce. So raw milk advocates, where the sale of raw milk is not legal, have in Wisconsin and in other places come up with variations on the following arrangement, which is usually known by shorthand as a herd share or co-op.
So yeah, it's essentially like a co-op. But people...
And the consumer buys a share of the farm. So now he or she is not supposedly being sold raw milk on the public retail market, which is what's regulated, but rather consuming some of the milk from their own personal herd or their share of their herd. And therefore is, at least in theory, beyond the reach of those regulations. This issue was unofficially tested in last year's trial of Vernon Hershberger.
Right. He is someone who produces raw milk, but he was not tried for selling raw milk.
That is correct. The focus of the official charges against him were all around retailing regulations under the Department of Agriculture, Trade and Consumer Protection and local health authorities. And he maintained that we are not in the public retailing business. This is our private thing. And therefore, we are not governed by those regulations. And he succeeded, his lawyer succeeded, in persuading essentially the jury that indeed he had not violated those retailing regulations because of that, which is why he got acquitted of 3 out of the 4 misdemeanor charges that had been leveled against him.
You write that Vernon Hershberger is kind of in the middle of all this, but he doesn't necessarily see himself as an activist and he doesn't necessarily relish the idea of fighting from a legal standpoint.
That's correct. Mr. Hershberger comes from an Amish background. He and his wife moved out from Ohio, where they grew up, to Wisconsin about 15 years ago, intending to join an Amish community in the area of Sauk County, but ultimately left that community, became estranged from it, and now do belong to another religious organization, church in the area. What both his upbringing, his Amish upbringing, have in common with the church that he belongs to now is a real degree of separation from the secular world in many respects, and very specifically being skeptical of the court system as a way of redressing personal rights.
Well, let's turn to the other side of the equation. There are any number of medical sources that oppose the sale of raw milk. And as you say, much of the dairy industry in this state does as well. What are first the objections of much of the medical community?
The principal objections associated with raw milk consumption has been at various times outbreaks of very severe diseases. When pasteurization was first brought in, a big issue was tuberculosis. But even now, E. coli, Campylobacter, and a whole bunch of other typhus diseases have been associated in some situations with the consumption of raw dairy products, unpasteurized dairy products.
And at the same time, what is the dairy industry's objection? The same thing?
Well, basically, they say, gee, we certainly are aware of this medical information. And I think the sort of the subtext there is we don't want to see anything happen that turns the general consuming public off of dairy across the board.
This is not
is their hypothetical, concern about what would happen if, for instance, raw milk were legalized in Wisconsin and then it became more widely consumed and then sooner or later one of these outbreaks occurred on a larger scale, that would torpedo the entire dairy industry. Is their fear.
They're not worried about an immediate direct economic impact that many people would go and buy raw milk. They're worried about an indirect impact if raw milk were consumed and bad things were to happen and people stopped buying milk altogether.
Well, that's the public statement. Certainly the raw milk advocates believe that latter suggestion, which is that raw milk would just further take away mainstream dairy product market share, is also part of the motivation. That's the claim on the part of the raw milk advocates. But whether that's really what's going on is open to question.
How much of this is linked to the broader trend of the local foods movement?
Well, and I think this is what has sort of fascinated me. I see the whole interest in raw milk as really just a kind of a logical extension or a further extreme, sort of out on the edge of that broader trend. And certainly the people who are involved deeply in attempts to make it more legal and to distribute it and so on would see themselves in that, in as sort of part of that bigger trend. And if you think about it, the whole organic food movement and working with local farmers and things like community-supported agriculture, all that kind of thing, the growth of farmers' markets is a popular source, and the increasing skepticism towards the big ag, big food complex
food Inc.,
all
if you will.
Play into that.
At the same time, you know, sort of one thing to look at local foods is, you know, knowing where your food is grown. I would imagine that opponents of raw milk would point out it's another thing to know whether the milk you're drinking is contaminated by potentially harmful bacteria.
Exactly. I mean, one of the people that I spoke to and include a lot in this story, a pediatrician and infectious disease specialist in Madison. I mean, it was very interesting because we got into this question about, okay, to what extent is this movement sort of part of this bigger one? And he says he understands that point of view. He himself is somebody, you know, they choose to go to a meat supplier that has grass-fed beef and locally raised. He's totally behind that. They like the farmers markets. The difference, he says, you take that meat home, you cook it. That will kill bacteria if there is bacteria of a bad kind on it. You take your lettuce home from the farmer's market. You wash it before you put it on your salad. And you can't do any of those things with raw milk, he says, which is certainly true. And then the question becomes, is the raw milk at that same sort of level of hazard that it would appear to be or not?
I would imagine, though, that advocates of raw milk sales would point out that the government allows the sales of plenty of other products out there whose negative impact are well known.
And that's
like
exactly
– cigarettes. Mean, and,
well, and not just that, but there's certainly been occasional outbreaks from things that are sold in the supermarket that turn out to be just as dangerous in those instances when an outbreak occurs, as is attributed to the unpasteurized milk. Part of the argument, or sort of part of the narrative that the raw milk advocates are trying to change, is the question of, is milk from the cow as categorically subject to contamination as is assumed? And they feel that the focus on raw milk per se is misdirected, and the real focus should be on the conditions in which cows are kept, raised, milked, fed, etc., that would have the biggest impact from their argument on the actual healthfulness, the presence or absence of pathogens in the milk.
This is the point that they would concede that in some ways there are potential dangers of raw milk, but there are ways to mitigate those dangers and sell raw milk safely.
Correct. And, you know, as one of the people that I talked to said, okay, if you take a factory farm, I'm not getting raw milk. You know, she said, you know, you can't just get it from anybody. You can't get it from a factory farm and expect it to be free of pathogens. But when you know the conditions in which the cows are kept and the milking is done and all that, that's where they say the focus needs to be.
There are 30 states in which raw milk sales are legal. Do you know anything about whether there are inspection processes to ensure the safety of raw milk in those places?
Well, each state is a little bit different in this respect. And in some of the states where it is legal, what in essence they have is a more formal legalized version of this herd share idea. Certainly there are places where there are some kind of inspection processes, others not. In Europe, there are places where you can actually buy raw milk from vending machines. I don't think this is actually in the story. It was like one of these tidbits that ended up on the cutting room floor when I was writing it. But there's that kind of thing, too. There's certainly all kinds of ways to look at the data on illness. And it has been pointed out by skeptics of raw milk that a number of the big outbreaks that have been reported in recent years were in states that had a more open market for raw milk than others. But again, the details are where people get into disagreements about what the real significance of those kind of data are.
Is there any way to determine how many people are drinking raw milk in Wisconsin or around the country?
You know, we tried to sort of figure out that. There have been some surveys that in fact would suggest that nationally the number is significantly more than has been estimated. but it's especially in Wisconsin where it is a semi-underground phenomenon. I think it would be very hard to come up with numbers. And what we don't have really are numbers about, you know, on sort of the flip side of that, on actual sort of sources and causes of foodborne illness in general on an annual basis. What happens is they collect a lot of data and they do sort of survey methods, but we don't know how many people got sick last year from raw milk, from pasteurized milk, from dirty salad, or any of those things.
We just know that this number of people got sick, but we aren't able to say because of this, then that.
Right. And then what we know is when there's a big outbreak of something associated with it, then attention gets focused on that. But it doesn't really go to the larger question of what is the overall trend that you'd need to begin to definitively understand this.
In short, there's something in the data for both proponents and opponents of raw milk to sink their teeth into.
Absolutely. And I think it's going to be that way for a long time.
Eric Gunn, thanks so much.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Eric Gunn is a contributing editor at Milwaukee Magazine. His article on the debate over raw milk sales in Wisconsin is in the March issue. Migrant farm workers in Wisconsin get the focus in Milwaukee photographer Paul Calhoun's newest exhibition. We'll talk with him about it next on Lake Effect. You're listening to us on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Photographer Paul Calhoun has traveled the world with his camera. From documenting life in the Republic of Georgia to Midwestern war veterans to migrant farm workers in Wisconsin, Calhoun's photographs are beautiful, sometimes disturbing, but always deeply touching. His newest exhibition opens this Friday in Wauwatosa, and it's a retrospective that showcases about 7 years of his work. Calhoun joins me in the studio now. Paul, welcome back to Lake Effect. It's great to see you.
Oh, good to be here.
I love the title of this exhibition that you have coming up. Dirt is my favorite color. And the photograph that you use as the flagship photograph for the exhibition is one that's relatively new. And there's a wonderful little boy wearing a T-shirt that says dirt is his favorite color. And is that where it all came from? Did it start there?
That's the idea for the show, yes. That when you're a photographer, sometimes things come together in a way that seems so, in a way, perfect. Not perfect for this child, certainly. This is a migrant worker in Wisconsin. Not that he works all the time. He's there with his family. But when things are ready to be picked and everybody who is a migrant worker is paid by piece. And so the children work when it's important for them to work and to make money. And he and his brother and sister had been playing and working and are dirty, very dirty, and he has this shirt on that just seemed to be a moment that was almost magical in a way, that it came together so that I was able to experience something and make a photograph of something that I thought was very important.
He's only three,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and he's working.
Yeah.
In our state.
In our state, he is. This was one of the first days I was out there, and it's not uncommon for young children to be working, in particular when they're needed. And families travel together, and since everything is paid by the piece, the more you pick, the more money you make. So that sometimes there are families of six or eight people working together in order to survive. And then once they're finished here, they may move on to another state to pick something else together.
For you as a photographer, I mean, this exhibition goes 7 years, essentially,
right,
of different work. And it's from all over the world because you travel and you take photographs of all kinds of different things. If dirt is your favorite color and you were putting this together, what other kind of dirt were you looking at? And maybe what kind of dirt was revealed to you as you were traveling?
Oh, actually, blue is my favorite color.
Is it?
But anyway, I'm not necessarily looking for dirt, but I think I'm bearing more reference to the idea of this photograph and photographs appearing to you as a photographer. I was in Kiev and in Ukraine near Chernobyl 2 years ago, and I was in an orphanage And there were a number of distressed children there, but there was a woman there who was just wonderful and clearly exhausted from the work she did. And I was there when they were getting ready to eat lunch. And she took the time to take slice up bread and arrange it on the table in the form of a flower. And I'm thinking, for these young people, what an amazing moment to come together and to be able to eat and have it be viewed as such a special moment when many of them come from situations where eating was in question and where their well-being was in question. And here was a woman who cared for them enough and was awfully busy and didn't need to do something like that, that really made something appear and be special for them at lunch. So that's more what I'm referring to. I mean, some of the photographs are from Milwaukee, and they're in a storefront church that's on Titonian Center. It's a woman that I met while I was working with young people at North Division High School. Her name is Mother Annie Naomi Scott, and she's been there for years. And she's a tremendous service to this community. She provides clothing and food, and she's also a Pentecostal minister, and she's 86 years old, and she continues to keep going, and she's an inspiration to everyone who meets her. So I did photographs in that. And that's not dirt, but there were moments when things came together in that situation that were just so special to me. And I hope that I've made photographs that reflect my feelings about those situations.
Most of the photographs that I've seen that you've made do expose the essential part of a person that you're photographing or the situation that we're looking at. You get below the surface, and maybe that's what I mean by the dirt. You know, you get underneath the slick surface of things, and to me that's what makes your photograph so compelling, is that I feel like I'm being let into a world that I wouldn't normally ever get to see.
Those worlds are my experience, and if I get beneath the surface, I guess – I mean, I teach photography. I teach at Mount Mary College, and I teach at MIAD, and I work with high school students in the city. And I think there are two directions, in particular with the advent of Photoshop, that photography has gone. In other words, we can play the role of disguising everything. In other words, in Photoshop, now we can make everybody's eyes the same size. And if we're too heavy, we can make ourselves thinner. If we're too thin, we can make ourselves. That's never been my interest. I've gone places and try to experience things. And I guess if my photographs succeed or fail are basically related to the depth of my experience. I know that when I'm putting together this show, I have a photograph of a young woman in Mother Scott's church. And I would go to the services, and I would not participate, but I would just be there. And so I've never really had this happen before. I felt somebody looking at me from behind. And I turned around and saw this young woman whose expression was so incredibly intense. And I made that photograph, and when I looked at it and I was framing it for this show, it was frightening. Because I don't think as photographers or as anyone, we don't recognize anything in somebody else that we don't have inside ourselves.
So what did you see in her that was in you?
Anger, in a sense terror, some sadness. We're all a complex mixture of all those things. Some of the photographs are very warm. I mean, storefront churches are a place where people come to have fellowship, to be with one another, to find support, redemption. I mean, that's a word that often comes up. And I suppose that's something that all of us feel, a need for that. And this young woman who was pretty much there by herself, I assume was there for some comfort. And so I think that photograph really reflects that.
Do you find it easier as you have done projects like this to be welcomed into these communities? Because that's part of what's going on here too. Yes, it's your experience, but people have to allow you to take these photographs, and they have to allow you in to see what you see.
I think I've become more patient with it, particularly with migrant workers. They have every reason to be suspicious. We're currently, I think, over the last half a dozen years, deported more people than in the history of this country. So they have every reason to distrust me. So this project, which I'm continuing this summer, has taken a lot of time. And one of the ways that I've broken the ice with them is I've taken family photographs of them, and I've given them copies of the photographs so that they begin to develop an understanding. And my experience of them has grown. In other words, many people think of migrant workers as being oppressed, desperate, but there's much more to it than that. I've learned a great deal about them in the process and come to understand how generous they are, how loyal they are to one another. Most of the time in the middle of the day, people eat lunch in the fields. And I'm there and I don't bring my lunch to eat in the fields, but it never fails that somebody will share lunch with me. These are poor people and their generosity just amazes me. And their determination amazes me, and the pride that they take in the work. Some of the families that I've met, the young people working in the families are the third generation doing this. And one of the things I've decided to do is that I don't think that my photographs tell the whole story. And so I'm this summer going to be working with a writer who's going to be doing oral histories. She's Spanish-speaking, and we very much feel that it's important that they speak in their native tongue, to make those stories as precise and complete as they can be. One of the interesting stories that I've heard is a woman whose father died of heart disease. He had a chance to survive, and surgeons were willing to do the surgery, but there was also a chance that he wouldn't survive. And instead of having the surgery, which would have potentially saddled his wife with immense debt, he simply chose to die. And she was in third grade when that happened, and that's when she and her mother and other children in the family went back out in the fields. Now she's in her 40s. This is what she's done all her life. She's from Texas. When she goes back to Texas, she works two jobs as a certified nursing assistant. And then in the summer, she brings her daughters, her sons, to Wisconsin to pick cucumbers and jalapeno peppers. And so I've had the opportunity to sit down to dinner with them, come to the trailer that they stay in, and they're so wonderful and generous. I mean, her daughters, they could be doing any number of things that teenagers in this country would want to do. But out of their sense of loyalty to the family unit, they come to Wisconsin and do work they really don't like. I mean, I don't know who could really like this work. One of the things that I kind of wish in the immigration debate now, in immigration reform, is that the legislators would just come out and meet the people that are working in these fields and really experience them for who they are. And better yet, if they tried to do this work for an hour. It's amazingly difficult and it's a grind.
Do you think that the project that you're working on might encourage some people to do that?
I think that would be optimistic, but I hope they would. I really hope they would. I mean, one of the things that led me, it was not only the immigration debate. My wife is an immigrant. She came here when she was 7 from El Salvador, although she's Chinese, which is another story. So that she went through her own experience as a child coming here. And there was a very small Asian population in Milwaukee at the time. And one of the things that she said is when she went to school, the kids in the school used to dance around her. And she didn't speak much English at the time. And they would say, "Chinky, chinky Chinaman." But she didn't mind because she thought that meant that they liked her. So, and my children, as being mixed race, have had different experiences. When we moved to Milwaukee, my son, the first day that he was here, somebody made a racial slur and he came home and asked me what it meant. So that's an issue that I have direct experience with. And I think it's important that all of us begin to understand ourselves more completely rather than pointing fingers and arguing.
And of course, it's interesting that using art, using photographs in your case, to help make that point.
Mm-hmm.
And how many photographs in this exhibit? It's not terribly big.
No,
is it?
It's 26, 27, something like that.
So somewhat easily digestible for somebody coming
right.
in.
Some of the photographs will be accompanied by interviews. I have a few from the exhibit that I did with my son after the wars. Maybe 4 or 5 from that. But the recordings that he did, the 10 interviews of combat veterans, will be there for people to listen to. And that exhibit actually in its complete form is up now at Mount Mary College in the Remy Gallery there. That exhibit continues and it's online still with WBEZ. And that was, I think it's meaningful work. I mean, I think it's important for people to see and hear. I mean, I think the heart of that exhibit is really the words that these veterans really shared with my son and as a result with the general public.
So once this exhibit – it's not up for very long. It's up for a few weeks.
What's at the end of March?
End of March. Okay, yeah. So about 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And you'll be going back out in the fields in the summer?
This summer, yes.
And anything else beyond that, that your projects that you are willing to talk about?
30 years ago, I worked in New York City in what was called the New York Chinatown History Project, and I met with the former director, who's now the director of Asian Studies at NYU, and we're talking about revisiting that work and doing more because New York Chinatown has changed tremendously. It's a different place, and he and I are very interested in working together again. And so hopefully we're going to make that materialize. I'll be working with students from NYU and making photographs, and it would be a wonderful thing to do.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah,
I hope so. Well, Paul, as always, it is such a pleasure to have you in the studio on the show, and I want to thank you for stopping by.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Milwaukee-based photographer Paul Calhoun's newest exhibition, Dirt is My Favorite Color, opens this Friday at Gallery 2622 in Wauwatosa. There are links to more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We'll take a short break now. We'll be right back with essayist Linda Benjamin on Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Grief is difficult, and everyone deals with it in their own way. But when it comes to interacting with those who grieve, Lake Effect essayist Linda Benjamin says there are a few common rules you should follow.
A shiva is a Jewish tradition, much like a wake but without the body, where relatives and friends gather after a funeral to comfort the bereaved. When my elderly aunt died recently, I agreed that we should hold the shiva at my house. What I came to realize as I observed the behaviors of some of the people in attendance is that some folks are truly unaware of how the ways they behave affect other people. I realized that the same people who were sensitivity challenged at our family shiva were insensitive not only on this occasion, but on many occasions. I checked with my multicultural friends, and they all agree that they, too, had sensitivity challenged members in their families. One example of such a person at my family shiva was a woman who interrupted my cousin upon his remembering his mother as drop-dead gorgeous to correct him. She was pretty, this woman felt the need to say. Another example of this type of behavior was an uncle who perhaps found any gathering of people the perfect venue for his political views. He scolded the bereaved daughter, complete with wagging finger, for voting for President Obama not once, but twice. After witnessing such gaffes, what I became aware of is that people who continually offend others are paradoxically unusually sensitive for themselves. They say and do inappropriate things at inappropriate times, yet if corrected, they act as if they are somehow the victim, never seeing how they themselves have actually created the very responses that they feel so victimized by. My experience is that trying to correct or stop them, however gently, is unwise. Any action or response to their provocation is most likely to worsen their behaviors, sometimes necessitating that, in a hospital, for example, security be called. At home, perhaps the police. Or should the behaviors escalate, even that a lawyer or judge be consulted for a restraining order. Instead of calling them on their behaviors, I would advise that you use the Jerry Seinfeld response. Remember when George or Kramer did or said something totally wacky? Jerry's response was to simply look at his friend, dazed with amazed curiosity, but not to utter a word. I'm not sure if this will help the sensitivity challenge, but for what it's worth, here's a brief list of what not to do at a shiva. First, remember that there is a time and place for everything. A shiva, which is meant to comfort the bereaved, is neither the time nor the place to correct others on their politics, their religious practices, or their personal observations about the deceased, particularly since the bereaved have only just lost someone important to them. This holding back your thoughts is a wonderful exercise in self-control. Secondly, do not confuse a shiva with a social gathering such as a gala or a ball, where you might rightfully expect to be waltzed across rooms of guests and individually introduced like Scarlett O'Hara Steen. Third, Food at a shiva is provided to comfort the bereaved and to thank the guests for coming. If the table doesn't appear to have available what you require, such as Coke instead of Pepsi or Stevia instead of Sweet and Low, either bring it along yourself, unless of course it is a pork chop, or live without it. Fourth, if the person in the kitchen is scurrying about making you a fresh pot of decaf, do not ask about where her children are living these days so as to helpfully inform her about anti-Semitism. We are depressed enough that our aunt died. Thank you very much. So it was through my aunt's shiva that my thoughts about the need for remediation for the sensitivity challenge came to me. Perhaps if people who suffer from this affliction could see their lack of sensitivity to others as a legitimate skill challenge, the way I see my need for remediation in math, they would no longer be asking the question they've been plagued by for most of their lives. Why don't I have any friends?
Lake Effect essayist Linda Benjamin is a clinical social worker in private practice in Milwaukee. She's also been a news broadcaster and has hosted a live call-in self-help show on a New York radio station. We will take one last break and then meet two of the people responsible for Feast of Crispian, a weekend Shakespeare intensive for veterans suffering from PTSD and other mental health issues. Lake Effect returns with that conversation in just a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. It's one of the most famous speeches in Shakespeare's canon, Henry V's exhortation to his troops before the Battle of Agincourt.
This day is called the Feast of Crispian. He that outlives this day and comes safe home will stand at tiptoe when this day is named and rouse him at the name of Crispian. He that shall see this day and live old age will yearly, on the vigil, feast his neighbors and say, tomorrow is St. Crispin's. Then will he strip his sleeve and show his scars and say, these wounds I had on Crispin's day.
That was Kenneth Branagh in a clip from the St. Crispin's Day speech from his 1989 film of Henry V. The speech goes on to talk about we few, we happy few, we band of brothers. And it's that sense of camaraderie and shared experience in wartime that led Nancy Smith Watson and her husband to start the Feast of Crispian at the Milwaukee Veterans Hospital. Using the characters and lines of Shakespeare, they work with veterans suffering from PTSD and a range of other mental health and reintegration issues. They're about to hold their sixth weekend intensive beginning this Friday evening. Joining Smith Watson in the studio with me is Shep Crumrine, a music therapist on staff at the Milwaukee VA. Welcome both of you to Lake Effect.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Feast of Crispian, which is, of course, from Shakespeare's Henry V, but it is in Milwaukee, a really interesting and unique program for veterans. And Nancy, I want to start with you. What is it and what are you trying to accomplish with it?
Feast of Crispian is the organization name of the project, which is Shakespeare. We're doing Shakespeare with veterans. And the idea came up out of a lot of really amazing stuff that was coming out of the education program out at Shakespeare and Company, which is out in Massachusetts. There was a group of professional actors and educators here in town who were looking to do something beneficial to the community out of theater and specifically out of Shakespeare because of the way that it affected us and the way that we were really passionate about Shakespeare. And I came up with the idea based off of actually a public radio show that talked about the intense need for first of all, they were talking about the need for mental health practitioners, but the story culminated in this whole idea that there are so many other kinds of programs that are needed that not all veterans will agree to go into mental health, straight up mental health programs, and that it doesn't always reach everybody in the same kind of way.
The more traditional types of
exactly,
therapies.
Getting therapy, okay. Getting group okay. therapy or one-on-one therapy. So I brought this to the group of us that were looking to do something, and talked with some other professional actors in town. Bill Watson, Jim Tassi are my other partners in this right now. We're the main facilitators in Feast of Crispian and are the ones that are doing these weekends. And came up with a curriculum, a plan, a form to put it in. And we knew what it could do for young actors and what it had done for us as far as certainly in a therapeutic mode. A lot of people go into all sorts of the arts out of a need for some kind of self-expression and a need to deal with, you know, developmental issues and sometimes trauma. And so we really had high hopes for what it could do. And yet at the same time, we thought, are we crazy? And then what we have found as we went into it was that a lot of people have received it in very much the similar way. We get veterans coming in on Friday night, you know, dragging their heels, not really necessarily wanting to be there. They've been encouraged to come by somebody over at the VA or somebody else. And by the end of Friday night,
so it doesn't even take very long.
It really doesn't.
So what is it about Shakespeare then? What is it about those words that seem so, in some ways, so antiquated to our ears now?
Yeah, well, I could talk a long time. My husband could talk a lot more about this than I could. He really understands the whole realm of what Shakespeare can do. But to shorten it up for what we expect it to do for the veterans that come in over just a weekend period, it's a couple of things. One, it has to work with a whole bunch of people. You have to have other people that are involved in it with you, which we think is really important. It's rigorous. It's something that they have to kind of sweat at a little bit. It's not necessarily an easy thing to do right off the bat. The words are metaphoric. You know, some people come in with the idea that, oh, I don't like Shakespeare because it's poetic. And then we convince them pretty quickly that we all speak in metaphor all the time. So that isn't necessarily anything different. But the largeness of metaphor and the largeness of language is what actually gives them an emotional experience. It's what the metaphor, literally on a brain level, if they've actually done studies where they show that factual language just works as facts in the brain. But when you use metaphoric language, it actually gives you a physical experience of whatever it is that you're talking about. And that's kind of what we're after with that.
And I imagine it would also give them an opportunity to express what they haven't been able to express.
Exactly.
In that huge, big way.
Exactly. And that's the other part of it, is that we never ask them to share their personal stories when they come in. What we do is we give them an ability to express the largeness of whatever their personal stories are with the mask of character and this container of the words of Shakespeare. They don't have to use their own words. They don't even have to be themselves necessarily in it. They're playing a character, and that gives them the ability to hide a little bit behind that, and yet at the same time to really release a lot of pent-up emotions and to express themselves. Our main hope, our main goal with that is that they just have the experience of having an emotional feeling. They don't even necessarily have to express it, and we're not looking for great acting. We're just looking for them to get up and have an experience, and we're pretty much finding out that that's what they're telling us is going on.
Well, Shep, I want to bring you in now because you work at the VA and you are a music therapist yourself, but you've been a champion of this program.
Definitely.
When Nancy and the group came to you, did they come to you? Were you the one who kind of made this happen at the VA?
Actually, it was, I think, Dry Hooch kind of hooked us up. But yeah, there was a handful of staff, but there's three of us really that grabbed onto it. Courtney Zeller's a rec therapist, and Andy Hendrickson's also an Afghan vet nurse that works over there. And we've pretty much been part of it from the beginning. And I mean, the first time we didn't know too much about it. I, as a creative arts therapist, have always recognized the power of creativity, the creative spirit, the creative energy that can be so therapeutic and healing. And so I, you know, had an intuitive sense that we were going to introduce something possibly very powerful. And as it turned out, it certainly did. And like Nancy said, after the first Friday night, I was blown away as to how quickly this group of people who really didn't know each other came together as a group and would not have missed the rest of the weekend for anything. I mean, a couple of those guys, you know, we twisted their arm just to come see what it's about, and they had plans to go bowling the next day or on some other outing or take a path. They canceled all that. They were there. 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock, whenever we started the next morning. It's that powerful.
Did you have any pushback from the VA bureaucracy about this? Because this seems like it's slightly out of the realm of, as we were talking about, the more traditional therapeutic models.
Not really. Feast of Crispian, they're volunteers, and they are signed up as official volunteers. So that seemed to be the easiest way to go. And we did get the blessings of the PTSD program director there. She became familiar with it, and a couple of the psychologists who were interested. So, you know, we had that behind us. So really no pushback. And I think, again, we've had music therapy and art therapy there for a number of years. The VA doesn't hire a lot of, I think there's only 2 drama therapists in the entire system. So it was our chance to sort of bring another aspect of creative arts and healing into our VA.
Well, and this has actually gone out in the internal VA around the country. I mean, mm-hmm. people are paying attention to this now. Right. I mean, it started here, but yeah. other VAs are looking at this.
Yeah, the national website. It's an in-house mm-hmm. online website that the national VA did a story on us a couple of months ago.
It's the Department of Veterans Affairs website, and, you know, there's a link to the VA News. They do a different feature every week, and this was part of the feature 1 week, yeah. But it was taped and edited in Milwaukee. So
how long has this been going on?
A little over a year, and we're about to do our 6th weekend intensive this coming weekend.
I assume it's open to any veteran who is interested, or do you have a limit of how many you can accommodate?
We do have a limit of how many we can accommodate, which we haven't had to really deal with yet, luckily, because I don't know how we would say no.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's we keep thinking that we're putting our limit at 14 per intensive. And we haven't yet gone over that, but I don't think that we could say no if, you know, unless we got 25 or something like that, we wouldn't be able to work with that many people. We haven't had to worry about it, but it's open to any veteran at any time, and also we've opened it to their families as well, because part of the idea is that a lot of times veterans come back and the family members don't understand what the changes are that have happened in them through their deployment experiences. And we wanted to make sure that that was open and that they could come and have this experience with their veteran loved one and maybe get more of an open-minded picture of what
they were going through. So have you had families come? And what's been the response?
We've had families come and observe at the end, and the response has been phenomenal. The very first weekend we had, one of our veterans was going through some really hard times and was in a very low state, and had a cousin come, and her cousin came up to us afterwards and was weeping and was saying, you know, I was seriously concerned. And after watching what she did with this weekend, I feel like she's got herself back. She's got her confidence back. And indeed, she's gone on to do wonderful things since then.
Well, and that's a question is, like, what has been the after result of all of this? Because, Shep, you're seeing the veterans. You're working there in the system. Are they having a positive result?
Oh, definitely. I have the advantage of having worked with a number of them in the acute setting. That's, of course, confidential. We don't know that as we're working on the weekend. But to see how people incorporate what they've done in Feast of Crispian into their overall treatment and recovery process, and then how that carries over in ways that some of the other things that they've – I mean, it all works together. But the Feast of Crispian has contributed this neat, unique piece that's enabled them to go a little bit further.
What do you think that is? What do you think it's giving them that other things haven't?
I think Nancy put it really well, to have an experience, to realize that you can experience intensity and survive that and you're okay afterwards. Well, they may not be upfront totally with what the connection is in terms of their military or their combat, but having gone through that experience, that emotional or whatever the experience was, the interpersonal experience, the relationship experience that develops, in connection with that, makes it much more possible than later to give articulation to some of those things that are more directly related to, you know, what they're working on in therapy. So,
and we hear that all the time from them. Like I said, we never ask them stories, but the stories come out. And we hear from them and from the staff and from other vets, oh, we've never heard that story come out of that veteran before. That's the first time.
Or they will say, I really haven't ever talked about this in my individual therapy to this point, But you know it's going to be much more possible from that point on.
It's almost like they're able to embody the experience.
Well, that's such a perfect way of putting it because, of course, being the somatic trained therapist in this as well, I'm really, really interested in bringing their bodies into it as well because one of the ways that we protect ourselves and one of the things that PTSD does is cuts the body off. It mm-hmm. keeps them from being able to have any kind of sensation, not just emotional sensation. And so to talk about embodying it is exactly what we're about, which, you know, like I said, we could go on forever talking about Shakespeare because there are actually reasons why Shakespeare helps to do that. Mm-hmm. It works specifically with the breath and with the heartbeat to really get straight into the body on a very tangible level. And really, we're finding out stuff. There's just such cutting-edge research coming out now, too, about the use of rhyme and meter in order to get pieces of the brain talking to themselves mm-hmm. again that stop talking to each other during PTSD. Mm-hmm. So there are all sorts of really amazing scientific reasons for why it's working as well. Bill Watson and I have another connection out in New York State, and one of the things that they're talking about too is that they also feel that one of the things that it does is it disrupts the kind of behavioral loop that they get into in certain situations, that it's so different from anything that they've ever done before. It really kind of knocks them off kilter a little bit so that it gives them an opportunity to imagine doing things differently than they've been doing. Yeah,
there's an emotional cascade that becomes automatic, a fear cascade, and that gets interrupted. You're experiencing similar things, but it's in this different way, and it's all of a sudden it's not the same anymore. And so it doesn't have to be the same anymore. So
that isn't as terrifying, perhaps.
Exactly. Yeah. The pattern gets broken. It starts to cycle differently and open up more possibilities.
So how do veterans find out about this if they don't already know and they want to participate?
Right now, the best thing for them to do is to go to our website, feastofcrispian.org. And they can contact any one of us through that, or they can leave us a message that they want to do it. At this point in time, the only place that we are offering this is in the VA. We are inside the VA, but we have hopes in the future to find a space outside. We're encouraged from some of our outside veterans that there are veterans that don't want to come to the VA. They want to participate in something like this, but they don't want to have to come into the hospital to do it.
And so that's future.
So
that's
in the future, we're doing that. But right now, we are in the VA. And they can find out about it through our website or
through the VA as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So if you're already in the VA system, it's a pretty simple thing mm-hmm. to find out. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, good. And my goodness, best of luck with all of this. And
thank
I hope
so
as the program increases, you'll come back and maybe we can get some veterans in to
sure.
do a little Shakespeare for us.
That would be great.
Nice.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Nancy and Shep, thank you so much.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Nancy Smith Watson is a professional actress and one of the founders and facilitators of Feast of Crispian. Shep Crumrine is a board-certified music therapist who works for the Acute Mental Health Unit at the Milwaukee VA Medical Center. The next weekend intensive begins Friday evening at the VA. Any veterans or family members interested in participating in the program can find out how on our website, wuwm.com/lakeeffect. And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks, as always, for tuning in today. We're looking forward to having you join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for listener-supported Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned now. Fresh air comes your way next.